since Adam Lanza opened fire in Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, a little over a week ago, the media coverage of the tragedy has been pretty nonstop. Much of the focus has been gun control. New life breathed into a modest assault weapons ban authored by Senator Dianne Feinstein. And we've also heard some references to the need for more and better mental health care. Recently, there's been some discussion of the everyday gun violence that disproportionately affects inner city youth. Some issues that haven't gotten much attention include the relationship between mass shootings and the increasing militarism of our country, the wars we're embroiled in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. And I haven't heard anyone really exploring the role that gender plays or why these mass killers are nearly always white men. So I wanted to talk about some of these issues with some other really smart women. And I reached out to a bunch and a number of them couldn't make it, but a few of them thankfully could. I'm joined in studio by Ilana Dykeman, author of many books, including the novels Beyond the Pale and Risk, and by Judith Merkinson, a human rights organizer and feminist activist, member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and San Francisco Women in Black, among many other affiliations. And on the phone by Kathleen Barry, the author of Unmaking War, Remaking Men and Sexual Slavery. What was your first reaction when you heard the news? Merk, do you want to start?
Well, I think my first reaction was just deep shock, and I felt so terrible for those parents. I just thought, as a parent, your life would be over. And then I thought of the mother of Adam Lanza, and in a weird sort of way, I thought, well, I don't know how she could have survived this, actually. And then, of course, then you start thinking about we're in an epidemic of gun violence and what it means, and that the society is slowly disintegrating.
And Ilana, you teach college students, including some young men. So I imagine that must have entered into your consciousness when you reacted to this terrible tragedy.
As a teacher, one of your concerns, I mean, this only happened in the last 10 or 15 years, but it became very obvious to every teacher I know that if you start to have a violent confrontation with a student, you have to back off because that student could kill you. And it's a very weird experience as a part of the teaching experience. I mean, this tragedy, though, has really made me meditate on who is allowed to have their anger in the United States and who is encouraged to do what with our anger. And, you know, I mean, the discussions, my private discussions on Facebook, for instance, have all been about gender and men and male violence. But the national media, you could watch it for days and nobody will say these are all middle-class white men who are doing this kind of violence. There's certainly a lot of other kind of gun violence happening in our cities that also needs to be addressed.
One of the interesting things that I just learned, I was looking up some statistics about gun violence, and despite the fact that there are now 89 guns per 100 Americans, compared with 6 per 100 in the United Kingdom, for instance, actually gun homicides are significantly down, less than half of what they were in 1993. There were over 9,000 homicides committed by guns last year. There were many more suicides, however, like about 3,000 more suicides than homicides. People have been saying, well, really, guns are less the problem than some other things in our society. Kathy, your book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men, begins with a story about empathy, how we show it, and then you go on to talk about how we suppress it in men. Can you talk about that process some, and especially how, if it could be reversed?
Let's start with Sandy Hook and realize that what we have seen in the last week, and immediately from as soon as the shootings were known to have happened, was an enormous outpouring of empathy on the part of Americans. Fear and anger, but a huge amount of empathy, and we saw it from men as well as women. So we know, and not just because of this incident, that empathy is not a gendered characteristic. It's a human characteristic. What struck me when I heard about that was not only the feeling for the loss of the children, the terror that the children who survived had been subjected to. These kind of acts go on regularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan by American troops without any American reaction to it, or the reaction is so small it doesn't even get noticed. And so I kind of am in the grips of really struggling with how to bring people to consciousness that empathy is not selective. It cannot be selective if we are to have a human world. You cannot have it in the context of patriotism only, for your own people, but not for anybody else's people. What I saw in doing the work and the research for Unmaking War, Remaking Men, and looking closely at how men are trained, the primary focus of the U.S. military is killing without remorse. Because if soldiers have remorse for having killed someone, they're not going to be very good at killing them again. Remorselessness is what we see in these massacres that take place in this country. This is trained, and it becomes part of an expectation of one's masculinity in war. You have to man up. By manning up, you've got to put any remorse or empathy to the side. Almost every soldier who has talked sincerely about killing refers to the first time they kill as a loss of soul. They've broken something of their own humanity by doing that. But they were expected to do it. They were trained to do it. They were told their masculinity relies on it. The model is made by the military, but it applies to all of masculinity.
I've read several different blogs about the issue of empathy in particular, but one of them, for instance, says, well, you know, it used to be the angry black man, but now it's the angry white man. And the whole thing was, well, these men are losing their power because of feminism, and therefore they have to find their power in other ways.
I read that same article.
Yeah,
and I don't think it was about empathy. She mentioned empathy, but I think she was just sympathizing with men. It was so, banal. It was so kind of
stupid.
Stupid is really a good word for it. But really, blaming us for men losing their power, and therefore the implication is they can't help but go out and massacre
right.
children. This attention right now is focused because it was mostly children who were killed. If it was mostly women who were killed, I doubt if we would be having this national pain over it.
Do you remember the that killing in Montreal where the guy went in and killed all these women because of feminism? He stated feminism was a horrible thing and he was just going to go in and kill women science students. But, you know, the real question is, so how do we change this? What do we do that we can to change both our attitudes towards guns in this country and the attitudes towards masculinity?
You are listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. My guests are feminist activists and writers Judith Merkinson, Ilana Dykewoman, and Kathleen Barry. We're going to take a quick break and return to this discussion about the mass shooting 2 weeks ago in Newtown, Connecticut, and how feminists can interrupt the culture of violence.
The dark has come, the city lights beam through the night. I sit alone and watch them through my wet window. But in another way, I know I'm not alone.
I feel my home just like a drum beat deep in me. Peace is in me. In my soul.
What role do you all think that popular culture plays in all of this? And I think I read somewhere that by the time a kid reaches 18, they will have seen something like 30,000 murders on television. Mm-hmm. Is it too easy to say that that's part of why we take killing so lightly?
No, I mean, of course, the culture that you live in impacts what you think and how and what you do. And I do think that if you live in a place where people are getting killed all the time, and to be the greatest means you have to be killing people constantly. I read this interesting thing. You know, a lot of these guys, they really feel like they don't fit in some way. They play video games constantly, and they want to become the character of that video game. And so I think that that does have in total impact. It's not the only thing. I mean, men have been killing and raping, you know, probably 100,000 years.
It's like they're only like five or six really easily available templates for masculinity. And there's one that's promulgated in urban neighborhoods and people of color neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods where male youth needs to both show their power and their masculinity by the use of guns and also respond to the hopelessness of their situations by violence and the bravado of we're all going to die young. But the white kids who commit this kind of mass violence have a very different kind of masculinist template, but it's still a masculinist template. They're raised on a video game culture where the video games kids are, men are mostly playing, are ones where people get points for raping women or for how many people you kill.
You know, I don't know if you saw the movie Salt with Angelina Jolie, in which she killed about 1,000 people in 10 minutes. And these people never get killed. Or the latest James Bond movie.
Right. Well, it's a program of cultural desensitization.
Yeah.
I think we're all subject to it.
Of course we are.
And I mean, I think it's really interesting that, you know, now as feminism moves to the next wave, that what we're seeing in popular culture is all these images mm-hmm. of women who are increasingly violent, increasingly willing to be as ruthless and kill as many the population of small cities as men,
right.
You know, and that's sort of supposed to mean we've arrived.
But also accompanied by masses of articles that say the end of men. You know,
right.
As if men are somehow women are rising up and men are falling by the wayside. And that just isn't true. And people, you know, it is true that the images of women and what women have achieved in the last 50 years is earth shattering. It is. But at the same time, the backlash against that is also earth shattering.
And when they write these articles about the end of men, I mean, what that specifically is referring to is this thing that women, for really half a second, were the majority of the labor force. But what that was about was that all the industries in which men are dominant, which is most industries. I mean, women are still incredibly concentrated in a few service industries. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just that all the construction jobs and all the manufacturing jobs had disappeared. And so the only jobs out there for this brief period were in like fast food sales and, you know, education and healthcare, the ones that can't be offshored. And women are a majority in these occupations, partly because they can't get into any other occupations.
Yeah,
right. It's actually much less about women gaining ground than about certain men losing ground.
And, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And we are still in a tremendous worldwide depression and mm-hmm. a great fear of depression. And I think that economic reality mm-hmm. causes a lot of violence.
Yeah.
Women have changed a lot in the last 30 to 40 years with the feminist movement. The expectations of women, the whole concept of being a woman, what that means, and of course that doesn't refer to all women, but there has been a huge change in what it means to be a woman in this society. The change on the part of men has been much slower, minuscule in many areas, and I think I go back again to saying, they have to start expecting it of each other. We have to start expecting it of them.
And how concretely can we make that happen?
I think it's really difficult. I mean, I live in just up the hill, a mile up the hill from where many of the intense black-on-black shootings happen every day. I mean, every day in Oakland, somebody is killed, almost every day. Often they're children who get in the way of gunfire or women who are on the way to the store for, you know, milk or whatever. And in the middle of the afternoon, doesn't matter what time of day it is, and they get caught in the crossfire. Well, really today I think we need a huge advertising company, a left-wing advertising juggernaut funded by $1 billion that goes around the country and puts billboards in communities and says things like, turn in your man card for a water pistol, and shows, you know, men having fun, different images that we can make. Yes. that change the culture, because we can talk all we want on KPFA. We're not going to change the culture of male violence.
The other thing is that we have to acknowledge that it's also an economic issue, because the billions of dollars that are generated through arms helps make this possible. I mean, you know, they always say guns don't kill people, people do. But if people didn't have guns, they would kill less people. And, you know, when people talk about here, when people talk about Afghanistan, when people talk about the former Yugoslavia, when people talk about Congo, part of what's going on is this massive proliferation of arsenals.
I'd like to respond to both of those, because I really agree that we need a massive media campaign. But I also believe it's possible, and I think we've seen evidence that it can be done. We've seen it with, you know, at one point it seemed impossible to do anything about cigarette smoking in this country. And we've seen through the media campaigns, as well as all kinds of other forces coming into being, that we've made huge changes in that area. And it was a huge industry that everybody at the time said, we're not going to be able to bring down this, because look at the money that big tobacco makes. But I think that there's reasons to be optimistic. And I think that we're at a moment in time where it would be possible to mobilize feminists and men who are really interested and engaged in wanting to change the meaning of masculinity in this society toward building a massive advertising campaign. The power of the media is overwhelming, and we do have some resources. They're not enormous, but the Women's Media Center is one good place to, you know, to think about launching something like that. But I think that we just need to call upon our movement and ourselves to start engaging in doing this, because it is possible.
I mean, you know, Warren Buffett comes to mind when you think of who could bankroll a huge
yes.
advertising campaign. But the question of who would control it and how, I mean, I just feel like everything that ever gets started, even with the best of intentions in this country, gets turned into something so cheesy or commercialized or counter to how it was conceived. And I mean, one of the things that I've been hearing people talk about is access to mental health care. And I think, well, that's long overdue. I mean, certainly in California, we know that when Reagan, you know, just absolutely eviscerated as governor, eviscerated the mental health services in the state, it really, you know, had this huge effect on everything from homelessness to violence. But I mean, I've heard people saying, well, we shouldn't use the term mentally ill. We shouldn't talk about this as having anything to do with mental illness because we don't actually know if Adam Lanza had a mental illness. And the question I want to raise is, I mean, is it possible, and I'm really asking this, I don't know the answer, is it possible that someone could have committed this horrible act and not be mentally ill?
Well, I think that whole idea that to have killed your soul to the point where you can go and kill any human being, you know, for any reason, is a form of mental illness. But to get everybody to agree to that, and, you know, and the flip side of the coin is that what happens is the mentally ill becomes stigmatized. And I don't want to be a part of that either, because, in fact, the percentage of people who are diagnosed as mentally ill who commit violent crimes is extremely small, and possibly much smaller than the number of people in the undiagnosed population. And, you know, to force every child to go through some kind of mental health evaluation and to segregate them that way is a little frightening. But to license guns is another question. You know, to have a test for licensing guns equivalent to what you would have to drive a car, at least, and maybe some psych evaluation, that would be much more a reasonable approach, I think.
First of all, in Unmaking War, I've gone to lengths to show how remorselessness turns soldiers into sociopaths, doing harm out of a position of remorselessness, and for the fun of it, which is often a lot of what happens with the killing and maimings in the military. I think in bringing up the issue as mental illness, there's a confusion between different kinds of mental illness. When you're talking about the shooter at Sandy Hook, the implication in the way it's being talked about as mental illness is someone who just kind of went crazy and went into a rage. What is much more likely is that he has sociopathic or psychopathic tendencies that can either be, you can either be born with or you can be trained into, as the military does with soldiers. And as a lot of the expectation of masculinity does to men. I mean, what do we say about students in college and universities who do fraternity gang rapes? I've written about presidential psychopathy, particularly using George Bush's committing war crimes in going into Iraq as evidence of how the White House, the standard for the White House, has become an expectation that presidents will commit war crimes. Voila, Obama goes right into escalating in Afghanistan, you know, within weeks of taking office the first time.
In some ways, you could even say that there's a national mental health problem because, you know, if people watch President Obama giving his speeches and his press conference and crying, I mean, certainly he had a great deal of empathy. And I believe he does care. I mean, I believe he's a caring human being, but it sort of doesn't matter if at the same time, you know, you're sending off drones and killing, you know, thousands of people somewhere else. So it's not just about empathy, it's about selective empathy.
Well, I mean, it's that ability. I mean, I have to say, when Kathy was talking about the sociopathic president, I really flashed on, you know, Obama, who can just ooze compassion and empathy and just seem like the model of the 21st century feminist sensitive man.
Right.
You know, crying. And I really believed it, you know, thinking about his own daughters and projecting this image of being so caring and at the same time being you know, the guy who's really stepped up the use of drones, which is the ultimate in alienated violence, you know,
right.
like the cleanest form of violence, you know. And I remember that it was Jimmy Carter who funded the neutron bomb because it was going to be so great because it would only kill people
and
not
buildings. Right.
You know, and yet Jimmy Carter, you know, I
the
think really is,
right.
and he really is, you know, and I think he really does care about all these people, but somehow in that office, he so didn't.
Right.
You know, and Clinton felt your pain, and he could convince people he felt their pain as he was cutting their welfare. You know, I just think, how is it that we keep being willing to have these people represent us?
This is also part of masculinity, of behaving in a way that in a hierarchy, as the position in the hierarchy demands. And there's a whole idea of, you know, when you're in office, you have to make tough decisions. And these are the tough decisions a commander-in-chief has to make.
You know, you referred to a few things that you've read or seen, many of which are highly inadequate. I'm wondering if you have read or seen things in the last week that you thought were good. And, you know, what's the best thing that you've seen out there, Ilana?
So one of the things that I was really struck by this week on the internet was a discussion of the history of the Second Amendment and how its original conception and use was to quell slave rebellion and to commit genocide against the Native Americans, that was the original right of Americans to bear arms, to form well-regulated militias in these very racist ways. And that's part of the legacy of living in the United States, which makes it really different than places like Sweden and Norway.
Kathy?
We saw Columbine happen, and we saw people get upset and sad and feel tragic about it. And then we saw Michael Moore's film, and we learned even more. And none of that has led to the enormous outcry this week about guns. There's a kind of moment that we have where we really have a national feeling about gun control that has just sparked something. And that's where I find optimism. And I'd like to just kind of close my part of this by saying that I think that we have some obligation to optimism if we're going to be talking about these issues. And I only hope that we can get the gun control we really need, but realize that if we don't change masculinity in the process, it's not going to change male violence.
The other issue that we haven't dealt with is state violence, really. And the fact is that state violence has increased enormously in the past period of time. The number of police killings of youth has gone up astronomically.
Yeah.
Nobody ever talks about that. The racism that's involved, the racism that was involved in how this has been reported. The very next day in the Chronicle, there was an article about a kid from Oakland, I think, who had a 3.6, you know, high school average, was about to go to college, he was killed. You know, black youth are being killed constantly. People will say, of course I'm sad about this, but what about the death somewhere else? Now, obviously, that isn't the way to talk about it on the one hand. But on the other hand, if we don't talk about, just as you did, Kathleen, if we don't talk about the issue of the mass killings going on in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, wherever, we aren't going to be able to unravel what's going on here.
I certainly was struck by how these white, young, middle-class, privileged children are the subject of so much empathy and so much attention.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a tipping point moment. You know, in Russia in the 20th century and still now, there were gazillion pogroms, but one or two caught the attention of the world and did make some substantial changes. In the gay rights struggle, there were hundreds and hundreds of deaths of lesbians and gay men and transgender youth. Matthew Shepard, tied to a fence post, changed things. For some reason, that was the one that caught people's attention. This is the one that is catching people's attention. And we need to be able to seize that moment and try to affect real change from that without devaluing or cutting out from the conversation all the other kinds of gun violence and male violence that we see happening in the world.
Although, I mean, I do want to say about Matthew Shepard that what we got out of it was actually more criminalization, hate crimes legislation, which has really been shown not to result in less violence, but actually to result in more state violence towards the same people who are normally the targets of state violence. So, I mean, somehow these conversations, I feel like, never end up going beyond how can we give police more power. You know, you hear people talking about, you know, we need more guns in schools to protect kids from the guns. And that's my fear, is that that when it all shakes out, when it's all said and done, that's what we're going to end up with, is more guns everywhere. I do want to invite our listeners, if you have thoughts about any of this that you want to feedback or become part of this conversation, drop us a line at kpfawomensmag@gmail.com. And hopefully this becomes the springboard for more serious conversations about these issues. My guests have been Ilana Dykewoman, author of Beyond the Pale and Risk, Judith Merkinson, member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and longtime feminist and human rights activist, and Kathleen Barry is author of Unmaking War, Remaking Men. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Thank
Kate.
You.
Thank you, Kate.